is taken from Genesis, chapter 49, verses 1 to 12. Then Jacob called for his sons and said, "Gather round so that I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come. Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honour, excelling in power. Turbulent as the waters, you will no longer excel, for you went up onto your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it. Simeon and Levi are brothers, their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council, let me not join their assembly, for they have killed men in their anger, and hamstrung oxen as they please. Cursed be their anger so fierce, and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob, and disperse them in Israel. Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, O Judah. Your return is from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Annabelle. Bit of a health warning for the sermon to come. The background to these sayings of Jacob is by no means entirely pleasant. And we'll be thinking a little about some unpleasant events. The Bible tells of life as it really is, and the mess and the evil that we find within it.
Second reading is from Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 to 8. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him." This is the gospel of the Lord.
Can I ask you to turn to page 55 in the Old Testament, in the Pew Bibles? We're going to be looking at Genesis 49. I wonder if the expression "the Lion of Judah" means anything to you. It is in fact how Jesus is described in Revelation chapter 5 and verse 5. And you may recall that an angel asks, "Who can open the scroll with seven seals, which tells what the future holds?" And an elder, sitting on one of the 24 thrones around the one who lives forever and ever, then says, "See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the seals." Sorry, he's able to open the scroll and its seven seals. And following that, in fact, it's a lamb that appears to open the seals. The lion and the lamb are one and the same. Jesus, who holds the future in his hands, who unlocks the future. And the lamb that was slain is the Lion of Judah. Do you know who called himself the Lion of Judah, a monarch? Anybody know the answer to that? Haile Selassie, thank you very much. Emperor of Ethiopia, until ousted by the Italians in the 1930s. He saw himself as a descendant of the dynasty of Solomon and was referred to as the Lion of Judah, which in fact is how Rastafarians refer to him today. The Lion of Judah shall break every chain, was a chorus I was brought up singing, and if you go online you'll find Phil Thompson and Robin Mark with much more recent worship songs expressing the same truth about Jesus as the Lion of Judah. But the lion was a symbol both of Judah and Jerusalem, and the origin of that is to be found in chapter 49 of Genesis that John Brooke touched on our Saturday morning session at White Birch Farm a few weeks ago. And I wanted to look at what is said by Jacob, or Israel, to use his new name, to his sons as he unlocks their future. And he says three specific things about Judah. First, he will be praised. Second, he is leonine, i.e. he's like a lion. And third, he will rule until the one comes to whom all rule belongs. Judah. Here again is another question. Do you know what the name Judah means? All right, we'll come back to that. Judah, he says, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You remember the story of Joseph, of course. And here, in relation to Judah, it's being said that the descendants of the brothers will bow down to Judah's descendants. Secondly, you are a lion's cub, O Judah. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? He'll be praised. He's like a lion. And thirdly, he'll rule until the one to whom all rule belongs actually comes. Here are the words. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. And the obedience of the nations is his. So there's something for the now or the immediate future for Judah and his descendants. But something else that's going to happen in the future. A ruler who is still to come. There's an historic point here, because Jacob describes how Judah will attain preeminence amongst the 12 tribes. But what you'd expect, of course, is the firstborn to have the preeminence. And that became the law, of course, in Israel as it came to be. If not the firstborn, well, failing him, the next in line, or the one after that, and so on. But Judah was the fourth son of Leah. You remember Leah? She'd been married to Jacob, who'd been deceived into marrying her by his father-in-law when he'd been asking to marry her more physically attractive sister, Rachel. Leah, I think, is someone who attracts a great deal of sympathy. She's described as having weak eyes. Perhaps she was short-sighted, or squint, perhaps. Who knows? But as compared with her sister, Rachel, who was described as lovely in form and beautiful, she came off second best, at least so far as men who looked at them were concerned. Well, you recall the story. Jacob falls in love with Rachel, but gets Leah as his wife, as the reward for his 7 years' work for his uncle Laban. And he gets Rachel on an undertaking to do a further 7 years' work. And so he has the two wives. But Rachel can't get pregnant. Leah can, and does, and hopes that the production of children will make Jacob love her more. And with each son, she hopes to gain the love that Jacob has, especially for Rachel, rather than her. And the name she gives to each of the sons reflect this. You can see her thinking as each son is born. First she has the son Reuben. Reuben, whose name sounds like, "The Lord has seen my misery." She's hoping that this is the way she will get her husband's love. But it doesn't make Jacob love her anymore. And she conceives again. This time it's Simeon, whose name sounds like "one who hears." So named by her, one would imagine, because she thinks that the Lord has heard her prayer and her sorrow and her unloved state. And then a third son follows, Levi, whom she hopes will bring about the devotion from Jacob that she seeks. And the name Levi sounds like the word "attached." And in modern jargon of socialists, Jacob and Leah have attachment problems. But by the time she has a fourth boy, she appears to be resigned to the situation. Perhaps she's given up hoping for the love that she wanted to have from Jacob. She's grateful to God for the son. And she says, "This time I will praise the Lord." And the name Judah means praise. Praise. Now, if you remember the story, Jacob goes on then to have four further sons by his two wives' maidservants. Before Leah then has two more sons, and then ultimately Rachel gets pregnant. And first Joseph arrives, and then Benjamin comes. And as Benjamin comes, she dies in childbirth. Benjamin, meaning "son of my right hand," named by Jacob, she calls him Benoni as she dies, "son of my sorrow." Jacob, as I suppose might be expected, given that history, but very sadly, shows favoritism towards the sons of Rachel. And the sons by his slave, the sons of Leah, or the sons of the slave girls. And in due course, what we find is that after the events in Egypt, that I suspect you're all familiar with, he actually adopts Joseph's two sons as his own, the sons being Ephraim and Manasseh. And that's why when we look to those maps in the Judges of the various tribes from where we live, there's no tribe of Joseph that has a spot. There's Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, adopted by Jacob as his own sons. So there's part of the background to what we've got happening in Genesis 49. Because when Jacob then gets to the end of his life, he speaks of the future of these sons and their descendants. And what he has to say about Reuben and Simeon and Levi is, to say the least, not good, compared to what he says about his fourth son, Judah, and indeed, if you go on in the chapter, about Joseph and his descendants. In fact, what he says about those first three amounts to a curse. And there's a reason for that, as you can see if you read back in the book of Genesis. Because what he says about each of the first three is a reflection of what each of them has done in their past. Reuben has forfeited his rights as the eldest, as the firstborn, and as the natural leader, you would think, of all the sons and brothers. Why? Because he slept with Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, through whom Jacob had had two sons. Hence the reference in going up to your father's bed and defiling it. incest. Strongly condemned in the Bible, and it's noticeable if you read carefully the story of Joseph going down to Egypt and all the rest of it, that Reuben has lost the respect of his brothers. And in the Joseph saga, he's unable to take the lead. He's unable to stop the brothers from selling Joseph down to be a slave. And when decisions have to be taken later in the story, it's not him who takes them. Leadership falls on Simeon and Judah. So that's Reuben. But Simeon and Levi have also stepped out of line. If you read chapter 34, you'll find that they've got a younger sister, Dinah, who's born to Leah after her sixth son and before Joseph and Benjamin arrive via Rachel. But in chapter 34, in an interlude in the whole of the Joseph saga, we discover that Dinah goes out to meet with some women who live in the area around, who belong to the Hivites. And she gets raped. And she's raped by Shechem, who is the son of the tribal leader of the Hivites. It's not just an entirely brutal rape in the sense that he actually wants to marry her. And he gets his father to go and ask Jacob if he can have her for his wife. But the brothers are furious at the rape of their younger sister, for whom they're obviously very protective. But their reaction is not to sort out the situation peacefully, but to murder the whole of Shechem's family and take their property. Jacob's reaction is predictably self-centered. If you go back to Genesis 34, you can see he says in verse 30, talking to Simeon and Levi, he says, "You brought trouble on me by making me a stench to the Canaanites and Perizzites, the people living in the land. We're few in number, and if they join forces against me and attack me, I'll be destroyed." And they respond, "Should he have treated our sister like a prostitute?" Self-righteousness, self-centeredness, the knock-on effect of the rape continues with the violence and murder. Each person reaps the consequence of their own wrongdoing and that of others. And the narrative tells us that this is the fallen world in which we live, where evil abounds. And however justified we feel in relation to the evil of others, we contribute to it by our reaction and our part of it ourselves. So I want to look very briefly at what Jacob says about Reuben and Simeon and Levi. Reuben, verses 3 and 4 of Genesis 49. "You are my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power, turbulent as the waters. You will no longer excel, for you went up on your father's bed, on my couch, and defiled it." He is to lose his rights of leadership, to excel, to lead. And then Simeon and Levi in verses 5 and 6. They're actually cursed for what they've done. The way he puts it is this: Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. "Let me not enter into their council or join in their assembly. I don't want to have much to do with them. For they've killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they please. Cursed be their anger so fierce and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel." What they all expected, I guess, was a deathbed blessing from Jacob, of the kind that Isaac had given to Jacob and Esau. What they get is the opposite: a malediction, not a benediction. And words have power in Old Testament thinking, and indeed in reality, as experience tells us. And what goes around comes around, as they say. They live under a curse. And Simeon and Levi are told that through their descendants they'll be scattered and dispersed, which is actually what happens when they reach the promised land. In Joshua 19, we find that the tribe of Simeon appears to be absorbed into the territory of Judah. And the tribe of Levi is scattered around. It doesn't have an area of its own because the Levites live in all the different towns in Judah. Neither is irredeemably lost or incapable of serving the Lord. In fact, we know the function the Levites had as priests and as singers and so on. Well, all this is, you may think, vaguely interesting, but how does this help us? Well, when Israel is on the verge of the promised land, as depicted in Deuteronomy chapter 11, we read that the Lord, speaking to all the tribes, says this. See, he says, I'm setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commands of the Lord your God. The curse if you disobey and turn from the way I command you. A blessing and a curse. And these are themes that recur throughout the Old Testament. We start with the curse in Genesis 3. As a result of man's disobedience in the garden. It comes again in this form, for even those who are chosen, the sons of Jacob. It appears in Deuteronomy 11, as the nation is about to enter the land. Again in Deuteronomy 30, and if you go through the Old Testament, you'll find quite a lot of it in Jeremiah and Malachi in particular. And even in the New Testament you find it. You may not think of that, but you'll find it in the words of Jesus. You'll find it in the parable in Matthew 25. You'll find it in Matthew 21, where Jesus curses a fig tree as a symbol of those who are rejecting him, those who should produce fruit who don't. Choices have consequences. Curses follow. Evil abounds. And it leads us to this question. Once cursed, always cursed. Once it's been spoken, can a curse be retracted? We all know that once we've said something, often we wish we'd never said it. I wish I could have those words back, because we see the damage that's done. Can a curse be overridden? And the answer's prefigured for us in this passage about Judah. It's the blessing on Judah. The chaos and the disorder created by the incest and the rape and the violence and the fear that follows and the curses, they're all met by a ruler who's going to bring order and peace and right and justice and who commands universal obedience. Judah's descendants are going to rule over those of his brothers in the future until the event of which verse 10 speaks. Until the one to whom the scepter and the ruler's staff belong. Those, of course, are the signs of kingship. You might think of the pictures you see of the pharaohs. You remember the pictures of the pharaohs, and they have a little crook, and so I can't remember what they do have on the other hand. A reed it is, I think, usually, isn't it? But they're symbols of kingship, and we have them in this country, and the scepter and the orb that the monarch has on coronation. But someone is coming to whom all rule belongs. The obedience of the nations is his. And he'll bring such peace and plenty, as it's described here, that donkeys can be tethered to vine without fear of theft or damage or shortage of food or drink. And he can afford to luxuriate in the produce of vines with an appearance that is so healthy that it shows his superlative nature. And so the answer to the curses that come upon us for our disobedience, in the same way as the children of Israel disobeyed, in the same way as we see curses falling on these particular individuals, the answer to the curses lies in this king who is coming, and whom we know has come. Instead, the blessing that's given to Abraham, and through him, to Jacob and Judah, comes through to us. I will be your God and you will be my people, to put it in very short form. And so I'm going to just finish by reading to you the words of Galatians chapter 3, which I hope speak for themselves in the context of what otherwise might seem the most dismal message about curses. Because the answer appears here. This is the real answer in the King who has come and who will come again. Paul writes this: all who rely on observing the law are under a curse. For it's written, cursed is everyone who does not continue to do everything written in the book of the law. Clearly no one's justified before God by the law, because the righteous will live by faith. The law is not based on faith. On the contrary, the man who does these things will live by them. And then this: Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who's hung on a tree. He redeemed us in order that the blessing given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles through Christ Jesus, so that by faith we might receive the promise of the Spirit. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. Thanks be to God and to our Lord Jesus Christ.